Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Dr. Patricia Tallman. Thanks for being with us, Patricia.
I'm happy to be here.
Patricia, can you start out by telling our listeners how you got involved in veganism?
Sure. Well, first of all, the way that I decided to become vegan was actually just purely based on ethical reasons. And it was through our first pet that my husband and I had together, and it was our rabbit, Ralph. And, you know, I didn't have pets growing up, and so when I got married and have our had our own place, the first thing I wanted to do was to have a pet. And I've always wanted a dog. But silly me, at that time, I thought, well, I've never had a pet, so I need something small to acclimatize myself to a dog, you know. And so we thought about, you know, something small. So anyways, we decided to get this rabbit, and we named him Ralph. And, of course, at that time, we were both omnivores, and both my husband and I grew up traditionally here in Vancouver eating a typical Western diet. But a few years after having Ralph, we sensed it's sort of like he awoken the gentle spirit within us. And it was because of, basically, I think his vulnerability and the fact that he was a prey animal that I think I began to see the world through his eyes. And that's how I started to make the connection with other animals that we now use as food. You know, and on hindsight, when I think about it, had I gotten the dog first, I may or may not have become vegan. And even if I had, it would have taken me a longer time to make that connection because dogs are predator animals. And, you know, I would have probably gotten him, you know, chicken as dog food or, you know, something similar to that. So I think that was a critical point in my life. And because of that, we thought that, you know, being vegans and being an example and just telling people was the way to go. But a few years into being a vegan, I felt that that wasn't enough. As I learned more about it, I felt that I really had to be a more of an advocate. So that's how I changed the course of my life.
I think most of us catch that vegan virus after a while. And you know, and you know, I think a lot of us are also influenced by our companion animals. I think my first cat had a lot to do with me heading down this pathway.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you had a rabbit because, you know, it does sort of that middle ground animal that's also companion animal and food. So you talked about trying to find a way to expand the message of veganism and bring more attention to it. And so you wrote the Restore Our Planet Diet. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. You know, actually, prior to writing the book, I'll tell you how the idea got started. In 2013, I started writing some opinion pieces for the Vancouver Sun, which is, you know, Vancouver's major newspaper. And by the end of the year, I had written 10 articles for them on, you know, mostly the environmental and health aspects of meat and dairy consumption. And so at the end of the year, I thought to myself, well, you know, wouldn't it be great if I could put all this scientific evidence into a single source so that people who are simply unaware or people who, you know, claim to be environmentalists and who are interested in health could find out about all these issues, you know, in a book. So that was the motivation for writing this book.
Right. And you certainly have the qualifications to do it. You have a doctorate in water resources engineering. So I think I'm sure it helps for many people to hear the message from someone in the scientific community and not just someone who's speaking from the animal protection or the environmental or the health side.
It's something that's overlooked by most conservationists, the amount of water that it takes to sustain a meat-based diet.
Yes, most definitely. Well, we know that, you know, worldwide, the animal agriculture industry uses something between roughly 50 to 70% of global freshwater resources. And explaining this is one thing, but what I've done in the book, which is unique, is that I show people, you know, what does it mean for a meal, What does it mean in terms of you sitting down, making a recipe? If you choose to go plant-based versus the meat version, how much water would you save, you know, and all the other rest of the parameters? And so I think it puts it in real personal terms for the reader that they can see, wow, this is the kind of impact I'm imposing. But on the other hand, if I choose to go plant-based, these are the benefits I'm giving to the planet and as well as my own health. And it makes it more real to them.
Right. Well, and also they're not just, the water isn't just used by them in providing food and water for the animals, but it's also highly polluted by their waste products in, all over the world as well, which is another gigantic problem that people tend to overlook.
Absolutely. And that's why in one of those parameters that I choose to quantify, it's the manure that could be diverted if we substitute the meat protein with a plant protein, because, of course, growing plants doesn't produce any manure.
Yeah, exactly. I saw that on your chart, tofu zero. Beef, 39
yeah.
kilograms of manure produced per kilogram of food. So you get 39 yeah. times manure as you get meat. I mean, that is a tremendous amount, and it's hard for people to wrap their minds around that.
But exactly.
I heard one time that, like, the state of Arkansas produces enough chicken manure to, like, coat the whole USA in so many inches of chicken manure per year. It's like it's an incredible amount of waste. People just forget
That's
about
it.
The fact that animals produce waste just like human animals do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's currently no sewer system or treatment plants for that manure. They have a big problem with disposal.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I mentioned in my workshops is that animal agriculture in the States produce an amount of manure that's equivalent to 3 times the waste of the human global population.
Jeez.
And you know, that's an enormous amount, and like you say, there are no sewage treatment plants for that manure.
I think, you know, one thing that we experience in this country is you have two sides generally. One side says, you know, the standard American diet, the Western diet, is the optimal diet. It's good for the environment. It's good for your health. And then you have the other side, you know, the vegan or environmentalist or animal protection movement, who says it's bad for the environment, it's bad for our health. But the one thing that I liked about your book is you took a step further and said, okay, so let's take this assumption that the Western diet really is what's best for the world and our the environment and the health. Let's talk about what the Earth would look like if, you know, the rest of the world, the 7 billion people, decide to follow this Western diet. What, you know, what does the Earth look like, and what kind of pressure would the world be facing?
That's right. You know, the one study showed that if everybody on the Earth follow the Western diet, it would require something like 4 planet Earths to grow that amount of food. And what about where are people going to live? I mean, real estate is quite the precious commodity nowadays, especially in Vancouver.
Right, on top of a manure mountain.
Oh, yes, that's right. So it's obviously not sustainable. And in fact, the UN predicts that by 2050 we're going to add another 2.5 billion people. So that would bring us to something like 9.6 billion people on Earth. And because of that, they estimate that, you know, if we continue the same eating pattern, the increase in demand for meat will rise by over 70%, and for dairy, it will rise close to almost 60%. So, you know, if we're using 50 to 70% of global freshwater just to grow what we're growing now, how are we going to get water to grow that extra food? You know, the critical issue or the limiting factor is that of water, because without water, humans can't even live. We can't survive, let alone grow the food to feed all these people.
Well, another aspect about the footprint analysis that people I find in my environmental science class, they don't realize that those footprints are calculated based on all resources going to humans. So basically, it takes four planet Earths and leaves nothing for any other type of animal or plant. I mean, it's all based on how many humans we can support, leaving room for no other animals, you know. It would be a pretty bleak planet with just humans and cow manure.
Yes, that's right. That's right. That's a really good point.
We can't get to Mars fast.
Yeah, because they're not. They're assuming that all the resources go to humans, so there's no water allocated for freshwater fish, no water allocated for water birds, no land allocated for wolves or deer or rabbits, nothing.
Wildlife.
But, yeah, nothing for wildlife.
The unique thing about your book is it really allows the reader to see recipes, but also the direct environmental implications and resources with each. Can you paint a picture for our listeners of what, you know, what's included when you break down a recipe, the different environmental aspects that you look at?
Sure. You know, first of all, in the chapter on environmental impacts, I think I talk about 10 different impacts, you know, as a direct result of meat and dairy consumption. But obviously, I couldn't quantify them all, but so I chose the three most obvious ones to illustrate. And they are greenhouse gas emissions, manure diverted, and the amount of water that's used. So, for example, I took a Sloppy Joe's recipe, which is, you know, a comfort food. So what I did was I, first of all, veganized the recipe by replacing the ground beef with ground firm tofu. You cook it the same way, you just replace that one protein source, and if you calculate the environmental savings in terms of the amount of water that can be saved, the manure that's diverted, and the greenhouse gas that was eliminated, you'll find that when you replace 1 pound of ground beef with 1 pound of firm tofu, the amount of water you save is 1,765 U.S. gallons.
Jeez.
That is an enormous amount of water in just cooking one recipe.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, right.
You know, to feed a family of four or, you know, feeding two males, depending on how much they eat. You know, it's very, I mean, what kind of a personal activity can you do to conserve that order of water savings? I mean, and it's so easy to achieve that. And in addition to that, you would divert close to 40 pounds of manure.
Jeez.
In just making that recipe. And the greenhouse gas you save, it's 11.3 kilograms of CO2 equivalent, but that's equivalent to about 27 miles, driving 27 miles.
Amazing, with just one meal.
And one low-budget meal, you might add. I mean, that's a very low-budget meal. A lot of people eat a lot more elaborate dishes than Sloppy Joe's.
Yes, that's right. And so I show this for, you know, a variety of beef recipes as well as pork, chicken, dairy, and eggs. And so people can see and try cooking a plant-based version, because every time you choose to go plant-based, you are giving some benefit to the environment as well as for yourself. And the more you do that, the greater those benefits are,
right.
In addition to saving the animals.
And then having the health impacts of cutting the red meat out. And I think that's a neat thing, too, is, you know, I know plenty of people who care about water shortages and various environmental issues, but they don't really care too much about their health, or they don't really have a great motivation to go on a diet per se. And I think this is a neat way to find a motivation for someone to live healthier for themselves and then healthier for the planet.
Yes, exactly. And this is also a great way to influence, you know, friends or family, you know, who weren't interested in considering a plant-based diet, because when they can actually see their personal impact, it adds another level of motivation for them.
What's your favorite recipe from the book?
Oh, my favorite recipe, I like the lettuce wrap. And, well, of course, I like all the baking things, like the banana bread and the muffins and the apricot squares. I'm thinking about that because the other day when I was doing a talk at a library, the librarian actually made three things from the baking section without eggs or dairy, and she is not a vegan. And she made, I think, the banana bread, the brownies, and the apricot squares. And she commented that, first of all, how easy the recipes were, and secondly, how fluffy and light the texture was without having to use eggs, and how easy it was just to replace the dairy with plant-based varieties because, you know, there are so many choices nowadays on the market. And so it tasted great. You know, it's better for your health. It's better for the environment. No animals have to suffer. And, you know, my point is if you can make delicious food with all these benefits, why not?
Yeah, exactly. I think it was National Banana Bread Day earlier this week. So I think I'm going to make that tonight. You know, in Chapter 2, you talk about health benefits. And just real quickly, I thought what was interesting is you talked a little bit about Kaiser Permanente. What's their strategy for trying to make – I mean, they're one of the largest healthcare providers in the U.S. What's their strategy for getting people healthier?
Well, they have advised their salaried physicians to recommend plant-based diet as a first line of defense rather than taking out the prescription pad in the prevention as well as the treatment of chronic diseases. And that's a really, really big step. And I have been trying to impart this message to the medical associations here in Canada. And, of course, I haven't heard a peep from them because I'm not a physician, probably. And I think it's just such a tremendous first step, and it really, really should be applauded. And of course, we all know that people like Dean Ornish, Caldwell Esselstyn, Nathan Pritikin, they have all demonstrated in peer-reviewed articles that they have been able to reverse heart disease with a plant-based diet. But there's no glamour and glory in foods, you know, but there is big money with drugs.
Right. I don't want to be too cynical, but, you know, a doctor isn't going to make much money by recommending broccoli rather than surgery.
No, and exactly. And I don't know if it's because of a vested interest in themselves or, you know, if they really profess to care about people's health, they really should at least give them that information. And I think that it is so critical, and I really applaud Kaiser Permanente for doing that.
Well, we just recently had Dr. Michael Greger speaking at our Vegetarian Society of El Paso dinner, and he thought that one reason that physicians are so reticent to address this issue is because they themselves are eating an unhealthy diet.
Yes, yes, that's a great point. That's a great point.
Do you want to tell our listeners where they can find the book?
Sure. It's available on Amazon.com, and a distributor actually liked my book, and so it's now being picked up by a distributor. So in the next month or so, I think it will be going into the stores in the U.S. I don't have a definite timeline for that, but it will soon be available at the bookstores.
We've been talking with Dr. Patricia Tallman. Thanks for being with us, Patricia.
You're very welcome.